Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast. Or, actually, hello, good afternoon, and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast. The only rugby podcast gives you all the news, views, and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are Mall Over Podcast. We are Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook. And you can find all of our podcasts on Anchor, as well as all other decent podcatchers. I am here this afternoon on a Wednesday afternoon in Cornwall with Phil and Ben, full Cornish contingent, or, well, based in Cornwall anyway. How you going, fellas?
Yeah, very good. Glad to be back. Been away for a while.
Yeah. Usually your technology lets you down in your cow shed.
Yeah. Obviously, nobody in Cornwall uses the internet in half time.
Yeah, or just on a Wednesday afternoon. How are you, Ben?
Yeah, good, thanks, mate.
I've been receiving some messages about you maybe getting a shout out or something on another podcast. What's all this about?
Well, basically, as you know, we've bought a puppy, and whilst I was trying to think of a name, I googled brave dogs, which led me to fall down a sort of brave animal Wikipedia hole, and Blood and Mud podcast around the same time started doing a war animals section. So I was fully genned up on the subject. So I thought I'd lend a hand and suggested a couple of animals that have won medals for them to talk about.
Did they actually talk? I mean, do you still listen to Blood and Mud?
Yeah.
Fair play to you.
So
I find Josh Gardner so fucking sanctimonious and condescending that I cannot stand listening to him anymore, let alone listen to his shit on Twitter.
He
won't listen to this, and I talk shit on Twitter as well, so it's fine.
But they've got a segment about dogs that save people's lives in shipwrecks, so, you know.
There you go. They're automatically better people than us, or me.
But yeah, I quite enjoy a dose of Blood and Mud every now and again. Listen to us first, though.
Obviously.
Nobody. I was telling Russ before you came on, Ben, that I was just been down to Morgan Porth, and there's massive swells because it's tail end of a hurricane coming in. And some woman who decided she was going to rush around to go and get up the coastal path got her timing badly wrong. Uh-oh. And got wiped out. And I can guarantee her dog was in no way, shape, or form helping her. As soon as it got hit by the waves, that dog was gone up over the dunes and disappeared.
Halfway up the beach, yeah. Don't blame it.
The joys of walking the dogs on the beach in Cornwall. I saw the watering hole was very close to the water at Perrin Porth at high tide. So, and this evening we're meeting for the first time socially distant. I hate saying that. We're meeting Ryan, aren't we?
We're going to have a big group hug.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. We're going to have a rule of six dinner and a drink with long time listener and friend of the show, Ryan Keyshaw. So that should be decent this evening. We'll all be gone by 10 o'clock, obviously. But yeah, we'll see what happens. Should we talk about some rugby? Let's start very briefly. Obviously, week before last was the European finals, Bristol versus Toulon and Exeter versus Racing. Two incredible games of rugby for finals, Phil.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly what you want from a final is two sides that deserve to be there, have been the best two sides in that competition, on an absolutely piss it down on we're talking European and actually came out and really threw themselves at it and provided the spectacle that you want for top European competition. And great, based in England now. Fantastic week rugby.
Yeah. Ben, did you catch either of the European finals?
I watched the Exeter game. I thought that the start of the game was a little bit subdued for a final, but once it got going, well, once the racing scrum half stopped having a what kind of nervous breakdown he was having, it became a really good game. And by the end, it was a full intense final and very much enjoyable. I mean, what he was doing, I've no idea.
He put Finn Russell in some spots, didn't he?
Well, he missed the kick to touch, the first penalty, he missed the kick to touch, and he didn't even miss it. He put it through the back of the dead ball area. Then he took a quick line out, which got turned over and cost them a try. Then he tried to keep the ball in from a kick into the corner and then gave away a penalty, and that cost another try. So I think he'd almost put them sort of 17 points down by the time the game had even started, you know, 10 minutes in. And they did very well to get back into the game, you've got to say. And you saw, like, Finn Russell, the just in a nutshell, wasn't it? You know, he scored, basically created two tries but cost them two as well. I mean, that pass across his own try line was suicidal.
Yeah.
And Exeter, they're the opposite, aren't they? They just stuck to what they do. And I thought Harry Williams was brilliant.
He's been brilliant for weeks now, for weeks. Phil, you coming in?
Yeah, no, I was going to say it was a classic example. Sorry, it's taken me a long... It's 10 days past now. I can barely remember what happened, but now it's coming back to me. It's a classic example of that team that plays tight system plays that has faith in what they're doing versus the ones that the team that's trying to produce that bit of magic to score a try. And Exeter just played their game perfectly. And there was somebody, I can't remember who it was, somebody in the commentary and had exactly the same in the Prem final, was calling for little Joe Simmons putting a little chip into the middle of space. And it's something that Exeter just do not do. They don't put the ball aerially or even along the ground between that first line of defence and back three. Never have done it. I don't think they ever will do it. And yes, you can see how it would be a useful tactic to do, but they just have faith in their systems. And we've spoken multiple times, particularly in an England context, about how teams sometimes are overcoached. But with Exeter, it is very much a case of this is what we do and we know that it works. And that's not to say they don't play exciting, free-flowing rugby. That's just to say that they have their pattern, they have their groups of moves, and they have their skills, and they just absolutely nail them 100% of the time. You could tell every time Exeter got that ball in the probably within 10 metres of the try line of Racing, they were going to score.
Yeah,
because they're always going to score. The semi-final they played against Bath was the perfect example of it, because Bath in the first half were the equal to them and had the bulk of possession. But every time Exeter got the ball, they got it into the 22, either by kicking a penalty a long way or by some good rugby. And once they're in the 22, it's inevitable. They're just going to score. I still think sometimes they should probably take the points. Especially in a final like that.
That will lead us on nicely to where we're going next, Ben. When we do get there. But sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I think sometimes they get a little bit I don't know, it's almost like they believe in the system so much that they think they're gonna score every time. And you know, especially in bad weather, you've got risks of the line out. There's always a risk at a scrum. And as we know, Mauls can be a bit of a mess. So I think in a final against a team that's got as much threat as they do, then perhaps not every time, but just taking the points might be an option at times.
The thing they've done to negate that line outside is just move to that tap and go. And I can't remember the... I think it was 17, they said, 17 tries they've scored this season from a tap and go from a penalty. And there is a near inevitability to it. There were times where actually, you're right. You go, this is a moderately close game. Let's take the 3 points, particularly in earlier games within the season. But I suppose the counteracting argument to that is, on the balance of probabilities, they score so many from close range that it's almost a banker for them. It's almost as much of a banker as a penalty. I mean, Joe Simmons has kicked 83% or something for the whole season. They probably score 83% of the time they get the ball in hand in the 5 metre, within the 5 metre line anyway.
Yeah. Ben, you mentioned something on the group the other day on the WhatsApp about the law changes and the way that that's been adapted since lockdown that might have seen Exeter suffer somewhat or might not suit their game plan. Are you going to bring this up in relation to the final, or was it something, the Premiership final or something?
I think it's a wider point, really. I think they're just the best team in the Premiership and probably, you know, in Europe. They are the best team in Europe. They've just won it. So it's not a criticism of them. But I do think since we've come back from lockdown with the new sort of interpretations, I just think they're going to have to change a little bit because I don't think they've had the sort of length of possession that they used to. So, you know, some games you would see Exeter play maybe a year ago, they would have the ball for 10, 15 minutes. And I just don't think that's possible to do anymore with so many new penalties at the breakdown. And because there are more penalties, even for the opposition as well as their own, I think it breaks the game up more. So they're not quite grinding as much as they were before. And I think they're more than good enough and their management is more than good enough to adjust to it. But whether they'll need maybe a jackler in the back row.
They're quite passive at the breakdown, aren't they? Especially in defence.
But I think even with that slow build that they have of making a couple of yards at a time, I think there's more risk involved in that now. And I think that it might just mean they've got to change a little bit. I think the return really suited Wasps more than anyone, as the results show. And Exeter, they're just better than everyone at the moment. So they were able to just make do. But I think you started to see them as possession, as the game sort of broke up a little bit and there was penalties. So it stopped the flow of the game and they started to look a bit vulnerable out wide, especially against Racing, but also a little bit against Wasps. I don't know. It might just be me seeing things that aren't there, but to me, it makes sense.
I think you're perfectly right. Even when they had Matt Kovacic, who was one of the best jacklers in the league at the time, they didn't use him as a jackler.
No.
But they've relied on the fact, the way the breakdowns have been refereed historically, is that if you get somebody there within a second or two, they can really fly in that clear out and take the man off the ball. Mm. So your ball carrier is almost permitted to hold onto the ball quite tight to start with. The way they're being refereed now is actually, to my view, the right way of refereeing it, because otherwise it allows teams to keep the ball despite not having that support quite as close as it should be. So Exeter have got two choices. Either they kind of, well, defensively, do they look to employ the jackler more or do they stick being more passive? Now, I would say defensively, okay, they're missing turnovers by not having that jackler, but their line speed and their aggressive tackling and the decision making in the tackles as to whether to go for the ball or whether to go for the chop tackle, I think is fantastic. And it means that they can get away without a jackler. But also in attack, I think they're going to have to adapt to have, particularly once you get into that kind of 13 channel and outside, they need to have a support player literally within a couple of metres of the ball carrier all the time, or they're going to risk those turnovers. And I think the other thing as a result of the rules is what you're seeing is a lot more jackler type players, be that sixes, sevens, hookers, and also some of the centres out in those wider channels, because they massively see it as a turnover opportunity. And I think potentially Exeter just don't shift the ball as wide as they used to counteract it.
Well, Exeter's game, secure the ball. I don't want to focus entirely on Exeter, but you know, they're the team that have had the most success, that have just done the double. So you know, it's where we are. But Exeter's game itself has never really relied on that speed of ball and out pace, is it? They're almost like the, you know, they do grind teams down, and when the option is there. But if you just got to look at like the players they use, I mean, Slade, whilst fleet of foot, is not Jonathan Joseph level quick, let's say, for as a direct comparison, as a 13. Jack Knoll isn't the quickest winger in the world, but he offers something different. I mean, I don't know, Ollie Woodburn is quick, but he's not he's not Johnny May. They're gas man's sort of O'Flaherty, isn't he? He's the one they use with pace. But they're, like you say, if they're going to start like other teams have done, and you mentioned Wasps there, who have benefited the most because of the way they play and the way they've come out of lockdown. They use a very mobile back row, and they move the ball very, very quickly, Wasps. I don't think in attack they don't keep the ball in and around the contact area very much. They tend to use the likes of Umaga. Gopathax is the pivot, and then from there they're able to move the ball either way. So that is where they've been able to benefit. And the likes of Willis, both Willis brothers, Thomas Young as well, who, you know, has been good. And they are able to, I can't remember who played seven on Saturday for Wasps. My brain is gone.
Thomas Young,
yeah. So and it does allow them to loiter in those spaces to enforce those turnovers.
I just think when Exeter get into the 22, historically they tend to then go 1 yard at a time, which realistically is going to take you 12, 13 phases.
Yeah, but they don't go anywhere, do they? And what they do is they dominate that contact area.
Yes, but they have to make sure they do that, because with the new rules making a turnover easier, you're risking 12 or 13 times on the way. Yeah. So it's not a big thing for them yet, but it may well become it.
Because what they're relying on is that ball security and then the opposition doing something stupid so they can kick it into the 5 meter channel and start a lot closer. Oh, I mean, the game plan is simple. Everyone can see it. Stopping it, on the other hand,
difficulty, and they're brilliant at it. And it's not like it's hit and hope, is it? They're so really good at it.
So go on, Phil. I was going to say,
if you look at it from the other side, so we're not just talking about Exeter. If you look at it from the Wasp side, you're right, Russ. That quick ball allows those players to move slightly further out and pivot off a Gopath or an Umaga, which works great if you're playing against a team like Gloucester, who perhaps might not be so mobile around the pitch, but also get sucked into those contact areas quite a lot. And as a result, they're sucked in and the ball's gone and you've got an overlap somewhere. Where it doesn't work is against a team like Exeter, who go, that's fine, we've made a tackle, everybody else is in the defensive line. And I think they almost ended up nullifying each other for 60 minutes of the final as a result. And the weather didn't help.
No, exactly. And that's where I was going. That's why I led with the European, because obviously we weren't here last week, is like two very, very different games in regards to the way it was played due to conditions or whatever. But you mentioned that quick ball that Wasps had, Phil, then. That was how they scored their try on Saturday. That quick ball that got Harry Williams isolated in that channel to allow Umaga to get through the hole. And, you know, like you said quite rightly there, that whilst the rain and the weather didn't help matters, I think the two styles of the two teams completely nullified each other on Saturday. And, Exeter took the points on a conditions basis, when they start, I think they realise to a certain extent that Wasps, because of their Jacqueline ability, because of their speed at the breakdown, they didn't want to make those errors, knocking the ball on or being turned over. That's why they took the points. And they don't do that very much, Ben, to your point to your point a few minutes ago. So obviously, as a spectacle, as a, you know, everybody wants the Premiership final, like it in May, usually in May, running rugby, nice sunny day at Twickenham. Having it at the end of October was quite different. And for me, it didn't make it any less exciting. I thought the game, whilst the game wasn't high in quality, the tension and the, you know, the, that's how I want to watch a rugby match. I don't want a rugby match where one team is blown away. You want a final that could go either way. And it very nearly did, Ben.
Yeah, I think actually both matches could very easily have turned at the end. There was the turnover by
Hidalgo Klein
in the first game, which was borderline, let's say. And then you had the very suspect line out call. Yeah. Or next to his line. I mean, I felt for Ogre Reaney,
yeah.
In those conditions. I thought,
properly stitched up, absolutely stitched up by whoever's calling the lineouts.
I mean, they never even got a man up, did they?
I mean, in fairness, I don't think it was even a penalty, because I thought Jack Yendal came right through the middle, still bound, and got his hands on the ball. I thought Craig Maxwell Key. What I will say is, before we just go back to talk about Old Grey again and the poor judgment for the lineout call, is there is a reason why I think that Craig Maxwell Keys was the seventh choice to referee that final.
To his defence, a little bit, that penalty was exactly the same as the one he gave against, I think, Willis about 5 minutes before.
Yeah.
When Exeter were on the attack. Yeah.
Doesn't make either of them right though.
No, and they were both suspect, but at least he was consistent. I've not got as big a problem with him as you do, but line out was I felt for the kid.
It was the first three lines after he came on. So young kid, Premiership final, absolutely horrific weather conditions. What he wants is a front ball, or at worst, a middle ball with a bit of movement to distract Exeter so they don't put up a front jumper. But it wasn't just where he went in the line out. All three of those line outs, there was absolutely zero movement from any of the Wasps players apart from the person jumping. So there's no disguise there at all to give him an extra 6 inches of leeway in case Exeter put a jumper up. I mean, it was shocking.
Wasps line out didn't function very well all day. I thought Sam Skinner had an absolutely excellent game in the line out, which was a bit of a shock as to why. It was a bit of a shock that he started, I think, obviously, with Johnny Gray and Johnny Hill doing such a great job. But the other thing about that Wasps line out at the end was Exeter just giving away. You know, Jack Yendal had just given away that penalty for bringing down the mall, however the referee had seen it. You throw to two, you secure your ball there and get some forward momentum. If you get that ball going forward, probably three things are going to happen. You're either going to get another penalty where you get to have another go. You push over and you score a try. And likelihood is, if you get a penalty, it's going to be a yellow card. You push them all over and you score a try. Or you push them over, somebody drags them all down, and you get a penalty try for it. I mean, the likelihood of actually being held up, knowing that they just received that penalty, the likelihood of being held up and it not of, you know, Exeter being able to stop it legally was pretty slim, I think. And I think it probably would have been in CMK's head to go under the sticks had there been another infringement at that point anyway.
So the downside of doing that front ball is it then becomes Exeter's primary aim to take that maul that's set and to push it off the side of the pitch, which requires just a bit more thought.
A la Rob Shaw.
to bring it down and then to stick a right pivot on it to make sure you're keeping in the pitch. Or even you throw two ball and an offload and reset up the ball 5 meters in. There's plenty of opportunities, but throwing to the back of the line without any kind of movement in front is just, it's just unfair on the poor kid.
Yeah, it really was. And like you say, or I said previously, the Wasps line out didn't function really at all throughout the game. But what we can say is, much like the final the week before, is that Exeter turned that ball over and then went penalty, line out, maul, penalty, line out, maul, penalty, line out, maul, 3 points. Literally, almost exactly
carbon
like
coffee. Yeah,
it was incredible, and that comes from confidence. I think, you know, maybe if they'd lost that game against Racing the week before, would they have had the confidence and the courage and their convictions to go and do what they did there? You know, Rob Baxter talked about it in his post match interview that, you know, that gave them, like, success obviously breeds success and confidence breeds confidence. And once they turned that ball over, you just knew Wasps were done. I think there were like 4 minutes left on the clock. And as soon as they turned that ball over, they had the not straight line out. They won the penalty at the scrum and that was it. You know, there was no way back for Wasps whatsoever. Go on, Phil.
You mentioned earlier Sam Adebo Klein. I think since he's come into Exeter, bearing in mind he's probably Scotland's fifth or sixth scrum half at the moment, I think he's been excellent since the restart. Yeah. I think his quality and speed of ball has been great, but also he reads the game really well and kind of reads the situation. I think he's been fantastic. And I suppose this is the only thing really from a... From a rugby perspective, maybe from an Exeter perspective, is whatever happens this season is always going to have a bit of an asterisk next to it. And you look at it and you go,
"Well, if you listen to Saracens fans,
well, ignore that bit." But not from a Saracens perspective. I meant from a COVID perspective. How much better have Exeter been because they've had Johnny Gray and Hugo Klein come in? I'm trying to think who Wasps have got, whether they've signed anyone, but certainly you look at Bristol and the big players, you look at your Earls, your Malins, your Randrandras that have come in and helped Bristol. Would they have ended up in a Premiership semi-final and you're winning a European competition without them? I'm just going to put a question mark not. There. We'll leave that to the listeners to decide, but no, they wouldn't.
I mean... So, what do you think, Ben?
Well, it's in terms of an asterisk.
Well, yeah, and in terms of the impact of this potential of the signings, I guess that Phil alluded to there across the board, really.
Well, I think, you know, they lost. What was the name of the scrum half, the Australian?
Nick White.
Nick White. So he was their obvious starting nine. So Hidalgo Klein was almost like a loan to replace an injury in effect. And well as he's played, I don't think he's as good a player as White. I mean, Hill is a big signing, isn't he? But he's a very solid player, but I don't think he's outstanding.
Who's that?
Not Hill, sorry. Johnny Gray. Cool. Yeah. You know, he's a good international player, but it's not like they've signed Brody Retallick or someone like that, is it?
But then you could argue, if you're looking at locks of the world,
yeah,
you could probably say Johnny Gray might be up there in the top five. Maybe. Is that a stretch?
I'd say he was the third best on that pitch on Saturday.
The system that they play...
What, behind Lawrence and Hill?
Yeah.
He's a perfect person to slide in for the system that they play. Hasn't missed a tackle since 1942.
Yeah, I'm not knocking the guy. I think he's a good, really good player, really good international. But, You know, it's not fits, like signing Retallick or
better than Retallick.
Probably does actually. Yeah, yeah. Is there an asterisk on it? I think there always will be. It's the COVID season, but what are you going to do about it? You know.
No. You take it in and you celebrate it like they have done. We had that situation on, when was it, Tuesday, Wednesday, when there was a possibility that Bristol were going to be playing. With coronavirus for Wasps, which would have been a much bigger asterisk. But
I tell you what, they should have done.
What's that?
They should have just
hybridized the team.
No, what they should have said was, all right, one-off game. We've changed our minds. Saracens, if you can beat Exeter in a final, you can stay up. That would have been the grudge match of the century, wouldn't it?
But on Tuesday, I was with a good friend of Daniel Thomas's, and he was texting him whilst I was there, and apparently they were still on the beers from the Friday night on the Tuesday, so they were dreading getting a call to say that they were playing in the Premier final, have to sober up.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been the right thing to do. Had Wasps not made it, they should have just gone, you know what? And everyone said, it's the showpiece, it's this, it's that. There was no prick in the stands. It's not like people... Yeah, but money from what, Ben? From the TV companies.
They'd have had to have paid BT back.
It's just ridiculous. You know, and the whole, I mean, you could argue a lot of the restart, and I know we've been down this road once before, or maybe more... The whole thing is a ridiculous
decision. When you got a team based in the Midlands and one in the Southwest, they should have seen if they could have played at Ashton Gate or something like that, because you don't need the extra stand space in there. For what it costs to open up Twickenham, it would have cost them a damn sight more money. They should have just held at Ashton Gate.
Yeah, and the RFU weren't doing them many favours either, were they? Let's be honest.
Nope.
We've completely sort of seem to have circumnavigated the two tries that were scored in the game. Two nice, well, sort of single man clean breaks, really. Henry Slade and Jacob Umanga. Very good, very nice tries. I mean, you can't really say too much about them, can you? Because they were literal individual tries.
If you're being super picky about it, on the Slade try, Willis almost had to trust whoever it was sweeping behind him to get to the winger, I can't remember who was standing out on the wing at the time, but Willis almost had to trust that man and not get sucked out wide, and the prop should have been much closer and closing up that space. But as soon as that space was there, Slade was gone, and that was that. And similarly, you can pick some slight holes in the Umanga try, but they're pieces of individual glory on a shit game, not a shit game, but shit weather conditions that everybody's struggling in, and both deserve their moment of glory.
Yeah, and Henry Slade getting man of the match, which I did find completely odd.
Absolute farcical.
Austin Healey for you.
Ball doesn't get outside 10 all game and you give man of the match to an outside centre. It's just a joke.
I felt a little bit sorry for... Gareth Steenson. I didn't know. So I think someone told me that he would have had to have been on the pitch when the penalty was conceded to be able to come on and take it. But it would have been nice for him to be on the pitch and kick that final penalty, wouldn't it?
Well, it'd just been on the pitch.
Yeah. Yeah. They could have just sort of subbed him on before the kick was taken, I guess, put him on at fullback. It was the last kick of the game anyway, wasn't it?
He's joining the coaching staff, though, isn't he?
Yeah, so it's kicking coach. Yeah. I mean, I think they've invented a position for him.
I'm not sure he cares that much, in all honesty. No. 10 years ago, wins a golden boot in the championship, and now he's got two medals.
Fair play. An excellent servant. And I think he was... But the other thing is, I think he was... two or three points, he's fifth on the all-time Premiership scorers list, and he was either two or three points behind whoever was above him. Paul Grayson or someone, I can't remember who, but Yeah, so farewell, Gareth. Go and enjoy the standoff and all the other stuff that you're going to be doing. Let's move on swiftly. After the game on Saturday, obviously everybody until sort of Thursday of last week would have been looking forward to the England Barbarians match. You especially, Ben. I know it's right.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely waiting for it.
Until it was cancelled, I guess. It wasn't even postponed, was it? Due to the actions of everybody has blamed Chris Robshaw. But there did appear that there were some other people there in that pub or that Italian restaurant, I think it was, where they were all having a good old drink and or whatever. I can't imagine that the people in the know didn't know that a group of at least 8 or 10 of their players were going out for dinner and having a drink. I really struggle to believe that the management had no idea about that. I mean, you can't see what in the video that circulated, you can't see what's going on the other side, but you don't know whether there was anybody else in that restaurant. Like you could probably say, or you could probably argue, if there's 10 professional rugby players in there, the likelihood is that there probably won't be anybody else in that restaurant.
There was obviously somebody recording it.
Not for long, anyway.
Yeah.
I get the fucking COVID bubble or whatever, but people, like, I was going to move on to the way that Twitter reacted in typical Twitter fashion, where they should all be hung, drawn and quartered and banished from the realms of rugby. And how can Robshaw let himself down and let England down and let all these people down? One of my favorite ones were, what about those England players that stood to win their first caps? And I was like, you know, fuck all, shut up. No cap international. Oh yeah, but it would have helped England's preparation for Italy. No, it wouldn't, because the people that would have played against the Barbarians would, the likelihood is most of them wouldn't play against Italy anyway. So it means nothing. The Barbarians is built on a social foundation. You know, the game should never really have been scheduled in the first place, in my opinion, which is the argument I tried to make. But the people, you know, the do-gooders and the they should behave better because they're professional sportsmen. I just don't get it. Why should they do it? Why should they have to do anything? They don't have to do anything. They're just normal people like everybody else. The people that hold them to a higher esteem than everybody else.
Yeah, if you're taking your moral cues from James Haskell, you're probably in trouble.
So the important thing to remember is this was a game between England third team and a bunch of random players who have, some of which have never been near an international side and some of which should never have been near an international side. It's such a nothing game that anybody who gives a shit about it clearly needs a better life. That's all I have to say on the matter.
Barbarians should play the Lions in a warm-up. That's what they should be kept for.
That would be much better. Although the Lions are playing Japan at Murrayfield, aren't they?
Yeah.
Which will be really good.
The tours are so short now that they could play the Barbarians. They could either play them where they go on tour or they could play them as a warm-up. You know, it wouldn't be a... I can't see it would be a problem.
No disrespect to some of the people in that list, though, but that has to be the weakest Barbarians squad.
The shittest Barbarians squad I've ever seen.
If the Barbarians were playing once every 4 years, it would have more of an attraction to the players. And if it was just Lions players that weren't available, then you would have, you'd have New Zealand, South Africa, Australia players available, and you'd have a lot of the home nations players that aren't picked for the Lions with a point to prove. So I think that would be good. But, you know, if it's just to play against England thirds, it's pointless.
It was basically some kind of celebratory showpiece game. whoever decided that England are going to play the Barbarians the day after the Premiership final has ultimately belittled both of those two teams, England and the Barbarians. The two best teams will be playing in the Premiership final, and they will have, on average, I don't know, 5 to 7 out of an England squad per side. So you've automatically taken half of your first team squad out of it, and you're playing not within a recognised international window anyway. So your Barbarian side is going to be based on who's available and in the right hemisphere. So it's just a bloody joke. It's nothing more than money, which goes against everything the Barbarians should be about.
Completely agree. And that obviously does lead us on to England and the Six Nations, the culmination of the Six Nations this week in Rome. Ireland are playing France. So Ireland are top of the group, top of the table at the moment, aren't they? And if they win against France, then they will win the Six Nations. If France win and England win, I think that should leave England to be the Six Nations champions, which are the only two sort of permutations, I think. Eddie's named his 36-man squad. Lots of people talking about who's in and who's out and who deserves what. And, you know, we've talked about certain players at length on this podcast. There's a couple of things that I do want to talk about this squad, is that there seems to be some credit for players who have impressed previously, but maybe haven't done it in the most recent history. And I will highlight Thokkan Asiga, who has been injured for quite a considerable period of time. He gets in whilst his Bath teammate, who I thought was excellent after the restart, McConaughey. I think, you know, it seems a strange decision. George Furbank keeps his place, whose form seemingly fell off a cliff since that start in France, where everybody was talking him up, and me included. But ever since, and even post lockdown, his form was, you know, awful. And I watched him against, was it in the European quarterfinal against Exeter? He basically gave them 2 tries as well. It was just not a good performance. Great to see Ollie Lawrence in there. I feel sorry. The one guy I feel sorry for is Ben Spencer. He seems to me like Willie Hines keeps getting picked. He's brought in Alex Mitchell now. Dan Robson's managed to get in finally. But Eddie Jones typically has picked this sort of game managing 9. No, Ben Youngs and then Willie Hines, right? Imagine if you had a younger, better player than Willie Hines that plays in a very, very similar fashion.
But he's a much bigger threat with the ball in hand. Yeah,
it's baffling, isn't it?
If you look to the rest of that squad, you would say, look, there's some things I don't agree with, but I can kind of see you thinking on most of them. But the Spencer thing is just, it's weird. I don't know what the problem is. And you know, that he held out against Robson for so long was also weird. I just don't understand it. Hines is injured now, I believe. But
he doesn't want a 9 who's a threat. He wants a 9 to shift the ball to a 10 and box kick.
But Ben Spencer's the best both of box which kicker in the Premiership.
Yeah, I know. Look, it's Eddie. That's probably the best that you can come up with. But on the whole, we spoke about how, and people laugh when I phrase it in a different way, how Johnny Gray's a better set than Brody Retallick if you play rugby the way that Exeter wants to play rugby. Eddie wants to play rugby in a certain way, and what way seems to change a little bit during the games, but he has a game plan he sets out to his players, and he picked what he believes is the right people for that game plan. And if you look at fly half, like, don't get me wrong, Umanga's playing pretty well, and he's had a pretty good first serious season at 10. Has he been playing better than Marcus Smith? No. Does Eddie like the way Marcus Smith plays? No. In the same way he doesn't like Danny Cipriani. Joe Simmons, obviously, his face doesn't fit, or there's something about the way that he plays that he doesn't like, because he's one match in the European final and controlled a game for his team to win the European final. He's captained his side to a Premiership final and doesn't get a look in. That's the one for me where I think he's really unlucky. Yeah. But for whatever reason, Eddie has his likes and his dislikes, and that's kind of just the way it is. And you know what? If they win, it doesn't really matter. Like, there's so many ways. If you could pitch players, it's like playing some kind of football manager job. It's like playing Championship manager. Yeah, Joe Simmons is better on this, but Umang is better on that. And there's always to be people that are really unlucky to miss out because of the way Eddie makes his selections.
Well, because of Eddie coach.
I agree. I know.
For me, the important thing is I don't really care about this game because the Six Nations should have been over in March and it's or April and it's now
and it's
October.
Italy,
I'm more
right.
interested. I'm more interested in next nations and starting again.
I think I agree with Phil. Like, you know, we're only a year away from a World Cup final, so you know he's got a bit of credit in the bank. And I know Russ, you're a big one for picking players on form and horses for courses, but I think to a degree you've got to pick your best 15 players and play them together as much as possible. But I do think if you were picking your best 15 players, Spencer's definitely in it.
Yeah.
You know, other than that, you know, they've got injuries, so you know there's a few guys that have dropped out due to that. You likes of Ford and Tuilagi. You've got Furbank is a bit of a strange one, I would guess, because Russ is right, he's not looked very solid at all. But you know, maybe a vote of confidence might do him the world of good.
It'll be interesting to see what he does, because Max Malins has been playing so well for Bristol at fullback. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised to see him start at fullback on Saturday.
Surely you'd start Watson at fullback.
Well, yeah. I think Watson will be on the wing.
I'd start Watson at fullback, but equally going back to your point that a vote of confidence would do him some good. A vote of confidence would do me some good for my six-a-side football on a Wednesday night, but I don't expect a phone call from Gareth Southgate about it.
Looking at this, the backs that he's picked, he's still got fucking Asiga, Farrell, Furback, Hines has now gone to his Mitchell, Joseph, Lawrence, Malins, Marchant, May, Robson, Youngs, Watson, Umaga, Thorley, and Slade. Now, if he's going to play Farrell at 10, then it's likely that it'll be either probably Slade and Joseph. So Slade would play that 12 role that Farrell plays, and then Joseph goes outside him. The other thing he could do, and going back to your point on Umaga, Phil, I think the reason that Umaga is in the team or in the squad over Smith, and I don't know whether Smith is injured, but certainly over Simmons, is that if you watch the way Umaga plays for Wasps with Gopeth outside him, Umaga doesn't have to do too much other than be a threat. So he kicks for touch, which is great. He does run the game at 10, but in my opinion, Jimmy Gopeth is running that game for Wasps. He is telling Umaga what to do all the time. For Marcus Smith, he is running that show at Quinns because he doesn't have that 12 outside him. Similarly, for Joe Simmons, he is running that show at Exeter. Now, if Farrell is playing at 12, he, for me, whether it's George Ford or Jacob Umaga or whoever, I think Owen Farrell will be running that show in the back line. Therefore, if you don't want two people maybe that are used to doing things their way in their teams and then going to England and having to sort of take not orders necessarily but take that sort of guidance from Owen Farrell when someone like Umaga is so used to doing it and does it very effectively with Jimmy Gopeth outside him at Wasps. It's a very similar style that that Wasps play, if that makes sense, using the 12 as a pivot rather than the 10?
I think Umanga will start on the bench, and that will be the change that happens. Will be a centre will go, and let's assume it's what you said, Joseph and Slade. One of those will go, the other one stays 13 or goes to 13. Farrell goes to 12, and Umanga comes on at 10.
Yeah.
That's the change that he'll make. I get the theory. I don't think it's the right decision personally, but I'm not going to spend any more time talking about it.
That's the thing, isn't
but
it?
But no, personally, I'd like to see on the pitch and get a decent amount of game time is Ollie Thorley. Because
yeah.
I think he is magic. I think he's a great player, but also now that he's bulked up a bit, he poses a real serious threat. And he's in much better form than Johnny Mayers at the moment.
Yeah, true. I mean, I mentioned Max Malins there as a fullback, but he could also play 10, obviously.
I think I would go with May, Thorley and Watson. I just think May might not be in very good form, but he scores pretty much every time he plays for England.
He doesn't have a bad game for England, Johnny Mayers, does he?
So
let's talk about the forwards then. We have got Tom Curry, Dunn, Earl, Yules, Genge, George Hill, Ted Hill, Itoje Launchbury, Ludlam, Abano, Dave Ribbons and his rave ribbons, Jack Singleton, which always seems an odd sign-in now. It's just almost like a standard Saracens player gets in an England squad. But then I don't know how much depth we got at hooker with LCD being unfit as well. Sinclair, Stewart, Underhill, Vinopola brothers, Harry Williams and Jack Willis. I mean, we are absolutely blessed in the back row, aren't we? I mean, Cunderhill, Willis and Ben Earl. Who do you think, I mean, rather than what you want, or we could do it both ways if you want, who do you think Eddie will pick in the back row? Do you think he'll stick with the World Cup of Cunderhill and Vinopola with Willis and Earl on the bench?
I could see him having Ted Hill on the bench covering back row. He likes a lot of who plays six. But no, I think he'll stick with Curry and Underhill. I don't think he's going to mess around too much for this game, and I think if he is going to mess around a bit, it'll be more for the Georgia game.
Because yeah, Jack Willis can both play eight and six, can't he? The same as Ben Earl.
I think he'll stick with the Vinopola, Underhill and Curry, and I think he's right too. Personally, I would play a 6-2 bench with Willis, and I would have gone with Sam Simmons if he was in the squad, but Earl is probably as versatile as Simmons, if not more so. So
yeah. I think Earl and Simmons are almost one and the same player.
Very similar. Earl's perhaps a little bit bigger, I think.
Yes.
But, I think you have to stick. That's a very good back row. And for all, there's been a bit of criticism of Billy. He's the only player that we've got back row wise who is like a shock runner. You know, a lot of those players run hard, but they don't bat
punch holes
in the same way that Billy would.
And the positive for Billy Ben is that he's barely played any rugby in the last 6 months, so he should be pretty fresh.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've got some players there, Dunn, Stewart, and perhaps Johnny Hill, who and Williams, who have really shone in the last few weeks. So they've kind of all, to a degree, got their chance through injury. And I think they'll all get a run.
Yeah. I mean, there's a load of internationals coming up, isn't there? Because England are playing Georgia as well. And we've got this sort of autumn Nations Cup type of affair going on as well. So, I mean, there's plenty of rugby to come. And it'll be interesting to see what Eddie does. Because, you know, every game matters. I think when's the pool stage draw that we've already qualified, like as in... The seedings for the pool stage draw of the next World Cup have already been done, haven't they? The seedings are taken so far in advance. I think that like what happens now won't affect the seedings for the groups?
I think it was the start of the Six Nations this year, because Wales had to win one of the Autumn Internationals to get into the top group, and they didn't, so they ended up not
because South Africa, Australia, New Zealand.
As in they needed to win one of their Autumn Internationals last year to have made it into top seedings. And they all might even have been ninth. Could it have been into ninth? Because
top seeds are South Africa, New Zealand, England, and Wales.
Wales, also Australia.
Ireland, Australia, France,
January 2020 rather.
Yes. So that's interesting. So England don't have the I think the point I was getting at is England don't have to worry, don't have that as a worry to experiment.
I mean, I don't think I would have worried anyway, having seen Italy on Saturday.
No, I mean, that was a woeful game, a woeful production and presentation. And I know there was some.
It's just been the same all Six Nations that they've just. They just run one man up into traffic and he gets turned over. It's just, you know, they've got good ball carriers in that back row, but they might make a couple of yards, but there's no one with them. So they're just getting turned over.
Yeah. And Jack Willis would have a field day against those, isn't
he? Yeah, totally. Well, Curry.
Well, I mean, Curry and Underhill, yeah. Whoever he plays.
The one thing to remember with Willis is he's not been away at the Six Nations or the World Cup. So although he's got that huge number of turnovers, he's probably played a lot more games than a lot of the other sort of turnover guys as well.
Yeah, so, that's true.
But he's still double the turnovers of anyone else.
Absolutely. He's incredible at the base. But in the way people are talking about him being so good, people have forgotten that Curry was brought into the side because he was so good at the breakdown. So, you know, the two of them in the squad, like you say, would just tear Italy to pieces, I think. The Irish back row just had a field day, didn't they?
Yeah, agreed. But it had the feeling of a pre-World Cup friendly. You know, like those games I had last summer before the World Cup? That's the sort of feeling that game had.
Well, it's because it was, I think all Italy's games in this Six Nations have been pretty much unwatchable. I mean, I'm saying this and they'll probably beat us now, but because they give away so many penalties and are at the moment pretty uncompetitive, then it's not an easy watch.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Well, somehow we've managed to get a whole hour through this. They did the European draw today. I'm not going to try and explain it because it is fucking mental. It's like the Premiership Cup, where there are loads of different groups and people play against each other, but not in the same group, but are in a pool with teams that they don't play. There are two pools of 12, but Exeter, unfortunately for Exeter, they have been drawn against Toulouse, so they have to play Toulouse twice in the group stage and Glasgow. There are lots of other teams. Obviously, Northampton have got to go to Leinster. Quinns have got a tough draw. Bristol, I think I need to have it in front of me, really, but I haven't. So,
I think the important thing is that whoever's organised this whole system clearly doesn't understand how people work, because it's totally farcical. You got people in pools, but they don't play other people in all the teams in their pools. So it's kind of largely irrelevant that they're in a pool and they can't play against teams from the same country. So they have to go overseas, which limits the number of teams that they could play, but they can only play ones from certain tiers. It's so overcomplicated. They've been better off going back to a massive, great big ball machine with all the teams written in and just pulling out three teams and saying, right, that's a pool of four. Almost like it was done historically.
That would have been great. But
sounds a little bit too simple, though, Phil. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, mate.
But in Exeter's Pool B, they're drawn in Pool B with Lyon, Ulster, Gloucester and Toulouse and Glasgow, but they only have to play Toulouse and Glasgow. Whereas Wasps play the Dragons and Montpellier. Northampton play Leinster and Bordeaux. It's just an absolute
shit show. It's always been a shit show of the best placed second place team in a pool. Ultimately, you can only be judged against the teams that you play against. You can't play different sides and then be judged on what your results are. It's screwed up. They should, I think, if they're going to limit games, which is the whole part of the reason they're doing this, is to cut a couple of weeks off the season, just go to a straight fucking knockout.
Yeah. Bristol have got to play Claremont and Connacht. Sale play Toulon and Edinburgh. It's just a mess. An absolute mess. And it makes a bit of a mockery of the tournament when you've got the losing semi-finalist and the winner play who beat them in the semi-final playing a two-legged pool match in the first stage. It's effectively turned into
a knockout.
All because they wanted to get that extra team in, or the extra couple of teams in.
Because they'll end up being judged against the winner of fucking Ospreys against some other.
Because now it's outside. Now it's the top eight from each. Is it the top eight from each bloody
top four from each pool going to knockout?
Yeah, it's fucking rubbish. Rubbish, mate. Rubbish. Right, let's move on. Let's go into any other business. Ben, do you have any other business?
I like the Lion shirt.
That's nice, isn't it? Traditional, yeah. Canterbury.
Yeah, if anyone wants to send us three, then...
I don't think the
Canterbury... missing out?
Oh, yeah, four.
Doug is not allowed one.
Well, he's not here, is he? He's not here.
Yeah. They can save on Doug because they won't need to pay the VAT.
It's true. Child sizes.
Yeah.
Phil?
So, dropping the tone a little bit, a couple of weeks ago was Baby Loss Awareness Week, and it's a matter that's fairly close to our heart, very close to our heart. 9 years ago today, we lost our son, unfortunately, Harry, I hadn't planned on bringing that up, but in the middle of Baby Loss Awareness Week, Chrissy Teigen and John Legend, or Chrissy Teigen had a miscarriage, and announced it publicly. And I say good on her for doing that. Ultimately, we all deal with shit when it happens in very different ways. And then the following day, Loose Women thought it was appropriate to discuss whether that was the right thing for her to do or not. You know what? You fuck the fuck off. It's got absolutely nothing to do with anybody else, how they as a couple choose to deal with their grief. So leave them the fuck alone and let them deal with things as they see fit. Loose Women, you can just piss off. That's me done.
I mean, very well said, Phil. I mean, even before any of that, I could have just said Loose Women, you can piss right off anyway. But you're absolutely right. I mean... I think, you know, at this point, everybody would maybe love me to go into a rant about the government and free school meals and Marcus Rashford and all the just the abomination of the situation we find ourselves in at the moment and how drastically our leadership is severely lacking in general. But what I will say off the back of this is, like, it's been really good to see, like, the local businesses that have struggled, the places that have been, who have suffered quite considerably during lockdown, where they weren't able to open their businesses and they weren't able to get their custom and they weren't able to, you know, to work. But they are selflessly, you know, putting themselves out there to give food and, you know, just give back a bit. And if anything, it's shown what a, you know, what a decent country we are of people in general, despite all the other shit that's going on with the leadership, despite all of the bullshit that goes on surrounding it, is actually inherently people want to look after each other. And especially when it comes to kids, is that, you know, it shouldn't even be a question, shouldn't even be a thought. So well done. If your business, or if you're doing anything to help or provide or do whatever, then my hat goes off to you, because, you know, you don't have to do it, but, you know, it just shows what a great community of people in general can do when they put their minds to it and put their hearts to it. So fair play.
Well done, both of you. I wish I thought of something better than nice shirts.
Well, it's up to you, Ben. So there you go.
Your point was equally valid.
Yeah,
it sounds like your dog's humping your leg at the moment.
He's actually not. He's asleep. Oh, you've woken him up now, Phil. Well done. But that was just me jiggling my leg.
shaking the piss out. Anyway, there we go.
A posh dog hump.
Yeah. There we go. We've got well over an hour out of that somehow. I think we'll probably, you know, we'll take an actual break now for a few weeks. Maybe we'll come back and talk about England and the Six Nations at the weekend, but it's going to be pretty dog shit in it, so maybe we won't. And we'll be back in a few weeks to the Premiership will be back in like 3 weeks as well, won't it? Like less than 3 weeks until the Premiership comes back.
And crazy, isn't it?
It is all pretty mental, but, you know, once it all gets going again, and we haven't got loads of midweek matches to worry about, and actual teams are putting out actual proper sides and taking it a bit more seriously, hopefully it'll make it a little bit better to watch and a bit more of a spectacle. So yeah, we'll be back at some point, but thanks for listening, and we will see you all very soon. Go well.